You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. The Missing Magritte, The Theft of a Deeply Personal Painting by René Magritte from a Belgian museum was a national tragedy. Now an investigation points to a greater tragedy still, by Joshua Hunt. Opening photo without a trace, Olympia, René Magritte's portrait of his wife, painted in 1948. The doorbell rang at 135 Rue Essingham, a modest row house in Jette, a Brussels suburb. The concierge was occupied with a pair of Japanese tourists visiting the apartment, which had been home to the surrealist painter René Magritte and his wife, Georgette Berger, from 1930 until 1954, and was now a private museum. It was shortly after 10 a.m., on September 24, 2009, when she excused herself to answer the door, the concierge found two young men waiting at the threshold. One of them asked if visiting hours had begun. The other placed a pistol against her head and forced his way inside. The armed men quickly rounded up both tourists and the three staff members on duty, leaving them kneeling in the museum's small courtyard, where Magritte had hosted weekly gatherings for painters, musicians, and intellectuals. With the hostages out of their way, one of the thieves jumped the glass partition protecting the tiny museum's centerpiece, Olympia, a 1948 portrait of the late artist's wife, pictured nude with a seashell resting on her stomach. The painting measured 60 by 80 centimeters, and was estimated to be worth 2 million euros. Belgian police arrived within minutes, summoned by an alarm triggered by the removal of the painting. But by that time, the thieves had returned to a getaway car that sped off toward the neighboring suburb of Laeken. It was uncommon in those days for small museums to bother installing surveillance cameras, so police had to rely on sketches of the two suspects, who appeared to be in their 20s. Interpol described one suspect as short, of Asian descent, and an English speaker, while the other was described as a bit taller, of European or North African descent, and a French speaker. Brazen as it was, the robbery seemed to be the work of professionals. A daring, high-value heist carried out with speed and precision by men who knew how to handle weapons, how to deal effectively with hostages, and how quickly to expect a police response. They had also been clever about selecting their target. Magritte, whose surrealist paintings influenced the work of Ed Ruscha, Andy Warhol, and Jasper Johns, is a national treasure in Belgium, where a number of museums display his work. But the thieves had avoided larger, more secure metropolitan museums in favor of one exceptionally valuable painting from the artist's former home, open only by appointment, leaving slim chance they would arrive to find it packed with more visitors than they could manage. With little to go on, one of the first police officers to reach the crime scene called someone he knew could help. Lucas Verhagen, a veteran officer with Belgium's Federal Police Force in a specialized unit called Section Art. August, a year ago, when I met Verhagen at police headquarters in central Brussels, he recalled the investigation from behind his tidy desk, next to a table piled high with old case files. He wore gray slacks, a short-sleeve button-up, and the scuffed black dress shoes favored by detectives and those who play them on TV. His face served as its own good cop, bad cop routine, friendly, disarming smile, penetrating blue eyes. They know very well what they must do when there is a theft, Verhagen said of Belgium's local police. But when it's art theft, what we need is a very good description, a photo, a maximum of information, very quickly, because we know that a lot of stolen objects go abroad. In the first hour, sometimes it's in another country. Verhagen was 51 at the time of the Magritte heist and had been a cop for 2 decades. It was a childhood dream that he pursued only after earning degrees in agronomy and biochemistry, then working for a few years in the private sector. His law enforcement career began with a 5-year stint on the local police force in Brussels, where he patrolled the central district of Belgium's capital city. Next, he worked as part of a special intervention unit that investigated organized crime and managed underworld informants. He specialized in Eastern Europe. When he joined Section ART in August 2005, Verhagen's years of particular experience proved surprisingly useful. Serbian gangs are heavily involved in trafficking stolen art and antiquities, Verhagen told me, along with organized crime networks that can be traced to Romania, Bulgaria, Moldova, and elsewhere in the Balkans and Eastern Europe. Our borders are open, Verhagen said. It's very easy to do an important art theft here in Belgium, and then the same night, or 15 hours later, they are in Croatia or in Albania. There they can sell the art to finance their own criminal activities, drugs, arms, prostitution. Continental Europe's first art theft unit was established by Napoleon Bonaparte in 1796 and was focused not on stopping plunder, but carrying it out on a scale unseen since the Romans took precious artifacts as spoils of war from Athens, Sicily, and Jerusalem. Napoleon's repository for looted treasures was the Louvre in Paris, where many of the works he acquired remain. In the wake of the Napoleonic Wars, and again after the First World War, a patchwork of treaties gradually tried to regulate the looting, destruction, and trafficking of art and antiquities. Modern art crime, like the arms trade, still thrives in the shadow of global conflict, which gives rise to criminal networks that make from the detritus of war immensely profitable commodities. There are master thieves and master forgers, but they are in small supply, said Jake Archer, a special agent with the FBI's art crime team. More so, it's accurate to say that there are transnational organized crime groups that are treating these objects just as they would any other illicit chattel. Outside of agencies like Interpol, the practice of art crime investigation tends to reveal the national priorities and even the national character of the highly specialized local agencies tasked with enforcement. In Germany, for example, the roots of art crime investigation at the Bundeskriminalamt trace back to post-war efforts to recover pieces looted by the Nazis. In France, the Central Office for the Fight Against Trafficking of Cultural Goods investigates not only art theft and forgery, but the counterfeiting of luxury items like Hermès ties or Louis Vuitton bags. And in Italy, where even the architectural landscape can qualify as protected cultural heritage, the mandate of a Carabinieri commando force includes the investigation of crimes involving archaeological goods. This is no small task, an officer from the Carabinieri tells me. In 2017, they went looking for signs of looting at Greek and Roman archaeological sites in Calabria in southern Italy and ended up uncovering a transnational gang in possession of some 10,000 pilfered artifacts. Belgian police first established a Bureau of Art and Antiques in 1988. 13 years later, when Belgium reorganized its law enforcement agencies, the unit became part of the country's federal police force and was renamed Section ART. Its team built and maintained a database of some 20,000 stolen objects and assisted local police departments throughout Belgium. In 2003, even as its staff began to dwindle, Section Art gained renewed prominence due to the increase in trafficking of illicit art and cultural goods, which resulted from the U.S. invasion of Iraq. According to one investigation, as many as 130,000 items were ransacked by assorted criminals and opportunists who sold them to Iraqi middlemen who then resold them to foreign dealers. Under such circumstances, it does not take long for an illicit supply chain to take shape. Because looted art and antiques lack the kind of documentation required for legitimate transport, professional smugglers are tasked with getting them into the hands of unwitting collectors, dealers, and auction houses. And because these smugglers specialize in shipping drugs for cartels, guns for arms dealers, and prostitutes or laborers for human traffickers, looters who start as amateurs soon gain professional experience through their association with this diverse array of criminal talent. In time, organized crime syndicates were joined by another major player in this illicit market for looted Iraqi treasures, the extremist group known as the Islamic State, or ISIS. In Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State sought to shore up dwindling oil revenue by selling raided cultural antiquities, which were sometimes trafficked through Belgium, where the Islamic State had no fewer than three major terrorist cells. One of these cells was called the Zirkani Network. With members based largely in Molenbeek, an impoverished neighborhood in Brussels that is more than 40% Muslim, the group's leader, Khalid Zirkani, was so effective in radicalizing Molenbeek youths that some called him a sorcerer who enticed recruits to pick pockets and rob tourists in order to raise funds. Certain key members of this network were, according to Belgium's federal prosecutor, Frederik van Loo, members of Molenbeek street gangs who became radicalized while serving time in prison. Next, photos in situ. The René Magritte Museum in Jette, where the artist resided for nearly 25 years, was open only by appointment. And the three photos here show the doorbell with the nameplate Magritte, the exterior facade of the building, and the interior showing the room where Olympia was on the wall. It was Van Loo who first told me about the theft of Magritte's Olympia canvas. On a cloudy afternoon in January 2020, we met at his office in Brussels, where I was conducting research for a book. As part of my research, I'd ask the federal prosecutor to explain the challenges of linking terrorist organizations to their financial backers, which he agreed to do over tea. When I arrived at his eighth-floor office, overlooking the sprawling Belgian capital, he poured himself a cup while staring down at Molenbeek, which has been called by its own mayor a fertile ground for terrorism. Since taking office in April 2014, Van Loo has been a driving force behind legislation imposing more severe punishments on former Islamic State fighters returning to Belgium, making him a prominent figure in Europe's broader fight against extremism and terror. But prosecuting those responsible for financing terrorist acts, he said, has become increasingly difficult due to microfinancing, Bitcoin, and the growing ties between terror groups and other organized crime networks. He used as an example a case which he'd been unable to prosecute. A thief had stolen a painting by Magritte here in Brussels, Van Loo said, and tried to have some money from the insurance companies in exchange for its return. Years later, when police learned that the man had been radicalized, Van Loo became convinced that the art napping had been a means to finance terror. But, he emphasized, this was only a theory, one that could not be proven in court, unless he was able to show that financing terrorism was, at the time of the heist, the end goal. The time for proving such things by then had passed. Rescuing Magritte's masterpiece was no small task for Section Art. Belgium's elite unit, which launched with 17 officers, had been diminished by waves of retirements and years of budget cuts. When Verhagen joined, he was one in a team of five. By the Olympia theft, Section Art consisted solely of Verhagen and his partner. He has a fundamental understanding and appreciation of the art world. He possesses the investigative patience, the persistence, and savvy that is necessary to navigate both the domestic and international legal systems, said the FBI's Archer, who once collaborated with Verhagen to recover seven paintings by the late Belgian surrealist Agnès Lorca, stolen long before from a fly-by-night gallery in Philadelphia. He values teamwork, which is crucial on these complex matters. He has a big heart and cares for the victims and the pillaged works. And he enjoys a touch of eccentricity that is common among the few of us dedicated art crime investigators. When Archer and his partner delivered the recovered paintings to Lorca's daughter in Brussels, Verhagen surprised his FBI colleagues with a special gift. He grows his own grapes and makes his own wine, Archer said. We enjoyed the bottle thoroughly. Celebrations like these are likely to grow rarer in years to come. Despite being one of the most profitable criminal enterprises in the world, surpassed by drug trafficking, arms dealing, and human trafficking, among others, transnational art crime is viewed as a niche field by law enforcement agencies and has allocated fewer resources now than even a decade ago. For Verhagen and his partner, as the last practitioners of their craft in Belgium, every phone call was important, whether it was from the FBI, Interpol, or local police. The high-profile Magritte heist raised the stakes. Recovering Olympia would be a chance to show their budget-slashing superiors why Section Art mattered. While helping his colleagues at Interpol prepare an alert for the missing painting, Verhagen also assisted local police in Jette by fielding and analyzing tips from a network of informants in the art world and the Brussels underworld. It didn't take long to develop information suggesting the involvement of a well-known organized crime figure. But rather than the Balkans or Eastern Europe, this information led to a working-class enclave in the Laeken neighborhood of Brussels, and a 20-year-old local named Khalid El-Bakri, the thief Van Loo would tell me about years later, who was growing out of teenage delinquency and into a life of crime and violence, a homegrown gangster raised by conservative religious parents who had made a nice life in Laeken after his father immigrated from Morocco. Because the heist involved guns and the threat of violence, a federal prosecutor granted investigators' request to employ special techniques, surveillance, wiretaps, and undercover operatives aimed at clarifying El-Bakri's role and gathering evidence. But because it was art theft, Verhagen said, his bosses considered the case low priority, which made it impossible to muster the necessary personnel and equipment. With few resources at their disposal, Verhagen, his partner, and a small team of local police set up a low-budget sting operation. El-Bakri, who fit the physical description of one of the thieves, had made contact with Olympia's insurance underwriter, offering them a chance to pay a reward of 50,000 euros for the painting's safe return. Rather than having to pay out the full 800,000 euro claim made by the museum. For insurers of fine art, such legally dubious arrangements are so routine that established reward rates are an open secret, as low as 3% of the insured value for items worth many millions of euros. and as high as 7% if the object is insured for 1 million euros or less. Market rates for ransom payments are not the only sign of the professionalization of art theft. In many of these art nappings, when the thieves don't have a way to contact the victim or the insurance company directly, they instead seek ransom payments through an intermediary in the murky world of art security. One such private enterprise is the Art Loss Register, which maintains an expansive database of stolen art. Unlike those maintained by the Belgian police, Interpol, and the Carabinieri in Italy, anyone can query the database, making it a resource for honest buyers hoping to avoid stolen art, as well as a kind of hotline for those hoping to ransom stolen objects. In some cases, Verhagen says, these private firms have gone as far as facilitating payments through shell corporations in the Maldives or Panama, making them difficult for police to trace. But even these efforts don't guarantee a painting's safe return, especially if it's been stolen by thieves, unfamiliar with this tangle of unwritten rules. What you have quite often in these museum thefts, manager of international art fairs Will Corner tells me from the Art Loss Register headquarters in London, is a high degree of planning in terms of the theft itself, but very little planning, if any, as to what they will do with the object after they've stolen it. When art museums fall prey to men more used to robbing banks, the results can be unpredictable. Depending on the nerve of the thief, a painting as famous as Olympia might end up being ransomed, traded for drugs, or burned to ashes. So Verhagen's team set a trap. The insurance underwriter for the stolen Magritte agreed to pay the suspect 50,000 euros, but they said to ensure that the canvas was indeed Olympia, they demanded the transaction be facilitated by an expert. In actuality, an undercover police officer working as part of Verhagen's small team. El Bakroui agreed to the meeting without hesitation, but when the day arrived, he canceled. A second meeting was arranged some days later, but he canceled that one too. With assistance from the Special Intervention Unit, Verhagen's team might have been able to keep El Bakroui under surveillance and scope out the meeting place ahead of time, but lacking equipment and personnel, all they could do was wait for a call from a suspect who thought the police were on to him. In the end, the local police opted to recall the few officers they'd assigned to the case. Officially, the investigation remained open, but without officers working on it, the case went nowhere. 2 years after the robbery, late in 2011, a retired cop named Jean-Pierre Cahen walked into a Brussels police station and handed over the Olympia canvas. I was contacted by someone who wanted to return the painting, Cahen said to local media at the time. The work was unsellable. They preferred a return to the owner over destroying it. Cahen, then 62 years old, had taken his pension in 2009 and started a private consulting business. His role in recovering the stolen painting barely 2 years into his retirement made him an instant celebrity in certain art world circles. But his clients are mostly insurance companies, he says, and the work he does for them consists primarily of unglamorous tasks like investigating fraudulent claims and uncovering forgeries. When I retired, they were very happy to have someone who knew the market, Cahen told me one hot afternoon in August, when I met him for a beer at a cafe in Brussels. Now 71, he possesses the countenance of a man very nearly at leisure and arrived wearing a mint-green polo shirt buttoned to the top with a fitness watch on one wrist and a Rolex Sea Dweller on the other. His ascent into the world of fine art and fine watches hardly happened overnight. Early in his career, Cahen spent 15 years busting prostitutes and pimps as part of a vice squad. Longing for something more and no longer enamored with nightlife, He went to work as a kind of liaison for Interpol, he says, before returning to the ranks of the federal police in Belgium, where he joined a unit focused on financial crimes. Many of his cases there involved high-dollar thefts and fraud, including art, antiques, and collectibles. One case, Cayenne told me, involved a pair of men who bought unsigned paintings in the style of middle-class artists, added their forged signatures, and sold them for 500 or 1,000 euros. In the beginning, they were cautious, selling just one or two paintings each month. But because the scam kept working, they eventually grew bold enough to bring 80 of these paintings to a Brussels auction house, which soon led Cain to their door. They couldn't stop, Cain said, because money, money, money. In the end, the men received a light punishment, Cain said, because judges and lawyers think of art theft and forgery as crimes that only affect rich people. This, he told me, is a mistake. These are greedy criminals, not romantics, and society coddles them at its peril. Fortunately for Cain, he is now in the private sector, where he is no longer bound by the strictures and protocols that apply to police officers. I have more freedom now, Cain told me. I'm not so restricted. I can go over the line. Take the Magritte case, he said. In the months after the robbery, Cain told me he heard that the thieves had not yet managed to unload the Olympia canvas. So he enlisted the help of an informant from his days on the police force, who told him the following. The Olympia robbery had been carried out on behalf of a Magritte-obsessed collector who walked away from the deal due to the intense media coverage. The stick-up men, whose identity Cain said he never knew, understood its value and had tried on a few occasions to sell the painting before deciding to work with the insurance company directly. Two times it was presented to undercover policemen, Cain said, referring to Section Art's attempted sting operation, but in both cases they understood and knew they were policemen. Some 2 years after the robbery took place, Cain said he asked his informant to relay a message to the person in possession of the Olympia canvas. It's famous. Nobody will buy it because it's in the press. It's on databases, Cain recalled saying. So, if you want, I can make a mediation with the insurers. In the end, 50,000 euros bought it back for the insurance company, which paid him his standard fee, one that he declined to disclose. He also didn't mention one relevant fact about his association with the Magritte case. In late 2009, not long before he left the police force, taking his pension 2 years ahead of schedule, Cain was among the officers tasked with investigating the Olympia robbery with access to all the information in the case file. In 2013, nearly 2 years after Olympia's recovery, thieves broke into the Van Buren Museum, yet another private home preserved for its cultural significance. Built in 1928 by the Dutch banker David Van Buren and his wife Alice, the red brick building in a municipality south of Brussels called Uccle is filled with paintings, sculptures, and a piano that once belonged to Erik Satie. In a reception room where the Van Burens had once greeted esteemed guests like Christian Dior, Jacques Prévert, and Magritte, the walls were adorned with James Ensor's Shrimps and Shells and The Thinker by Kees van Dongen. In a little more than 2 minutes, a couple hours before sunrise on July 16th, the intruders escaped with these paintings, plus 10 other works. Neighbors saw as many as 4 men leaving the crime scene in a BMW. One said he heard them speaking French. In the years since the Magritte heist, Verhagen's only other colleague in the art crime unit had retired. He was now Section Art in its entirety. With a small team of Uccle police, he chased down leads and worked informants to no avail. A few weeks after the Van Buren robbery, police in Uccle received a visit from the retired cop-turned-consultant Jean-Pierre Cayenne. If they brought him into the fold, he claimed, he could help them solve the case and recover the missing paintings. But the architects of the Olympia heist remained at large years after Cahen delivered the painting, and Ukli police didn't take him up on his offer. Multiple requests for comment went unanswered by representatives of the Ukli Police Department. According to Verhagen, officials are often hesitant to work with private detectives and consultants in the art world because he says they stimulate just that type of theft and illicit markets. They have been known to aggressively seek out the identity of victims from the police, then hold back information that might aid criminal investigators. Around this time, Cahen told me, he was contacted by an unknown person regarding the Van Dongen painting. Acting on behalf of the insurer, Cahen says he met with this individual and proposed a finder's fee of 10% of the painting's value. Cahen later received an SMS message saying the amount was insufficient and says he had no further contact. Cahen's website describes his services as offering guidance through the wilderness of police and private databases. While Belgian law prohibits police officers from working as private detectives for at least 5 years after their retirement, and Cahen returned Olympia just 2 years after leaving the force, he stays within the red tape by identifying as a consultant and, he says, contracting recognized detectives when needed. When I ask via email whether he hired a detective in the Magritte case, he responded, "This was not necessary in this case. I have not conducted a proactive investigation." However, he had previously described to me the lengths he'd taken to track down Olympia. I contacted one of my informants from my former unit and said, "Look, you can't do anything with it. It's known. It's famous. Nobody will buy it because it's in the press." Verhagen, a stickler for the rules, avoided such gray areas. But in early 2014, his personal stakes in the Van Buren case ratcheted up even further when he was told that his unit would soon be shut down completely due to budget cuts. If he could bring in the thieves on such a high-profile case, he thought, he might be able to save the department. With few resources and a ticking clock, Verhagen rededicated himself to the thin evidence he had to go on and a gnawing hunch. He had felt from the beginning that the robbery was related to the 2009 Magritte heist. Nearly 2 years into the investigation, he finally found evidence that seemed to confirm this. In March 2015, police received information that Khalid El-Bakroui, the man who had been a prime suspect in Verhagen's Olympia case, and who authorities believed was the recipient of the 50,000 euro payout arranged by Cahen, was trying to make contact with the insurance company responsible for the Van Buren Museum's policy. In the years since his last brush with Section Art, El-Bakroui had been busy. About 1 month after the Magritte heist, he'd grabbed a Kalashnikov rifle and robbed a Brussels bank, along with two accomplices. 2 weeks later, after carjacking an Audi S3, El-Bakroui was detained by police, who found him in a warehouse filled with stolen cars. Somehow, he evaded charges until September 2011, when he was convicted of criminal conspiracy, armed robbery, and possession of stolen cars and weapons. His prison sentence began around the time Olympia was recovered, and he was paroled with an electronic monitor 2 months before the Van Buren Museum heist took place. El-Bakroui's believed involvement in the case offered hope for the art crime unit, because he was already making inquiries about ransoming paintings from the Van Buren robbery. Bringing him in would simply be a matter of securing the insurance company's cooperation. Once again, the insurance underwriter agreed to refer El-Bakroui to an independent expert, who was, in reality, an undercover police officer. But an anonymously sourced article soon appeared in the national press, stating that the police had made contact with the suspects in the robbery. This was seen as a warning, according to a member of the investigation. Someone with inside knowledge was sending a message to the art nappers to let them know that the police were on to them. Following the article's release, El Bakroui went dark and once again slipped away. Verhagen would not hear his name again until March 2016, when it was on the lips of everyone in Belgium. In June 2015, authorities in Gaziantep, Turkey, detained Ibrahim El Bakroui, Khalid's older brother, on the suspicion that he was planning to enter Syria to fight for the Islamic State. But instead of extraditing him to Belgium, where he would have been incarcerated for violating the terms of his parole, Turkish authorities, at his request, sent him only as far as the Netherlands, and he returned to Brussels on his own. Ibrahim was, like his brother, already associating with men with known terrorist links. In 2010, he had been involved in what the mayor of Brussels then called a run-of-the-mill crime, an attempted robbery of a Western Union. Armed with a Kalashnikov, Ibrahim shot a police officer in the leg before escaping with his colleagues to a home in Laeken. Police caught up with them there the next morning, and El Bakroui was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He served less than half of his sentence, during which time his radicalization only accelerated, before being paroled in October 2014. 7 months after his brother's parole in May 2015, Khalid El Bakroui was arrested for meeting with a known criminal, which was a violation of the terms of his own parole. But because he was otherwise in accordance with the conditions of his release, the judge set him free. In August, after he once again violated the terms of his parole, Interpol issued a warrant for his arrest, but he evaded capture by using the alias Ibrahim Maroufi. In September, he rented an apartment 40 miles south of Brussels, which was used as a safe house by Abdelhamid Aboud and other Islamic State militants, as they plotted and carried out terror attacks in Paris in November 2015, killing 130 people. Just 4 months later, the El Bakroui brothers carried out their own terror attacks in Brussels. On the morning of March 22, 2016, Ibrahim blew himself up in the departure hall at Zaventem Airport. Just over an hour later, Khalid blew himself up while riding inside a train pulling out of Malbik station. The explosions killed 32 bystanders. "I saw it," Verhagen says. "We have here the same guy, so I made a report for our direction and commander-in-chief, and their comments were very laconic, just, okay, it's not proof that they used that money for their terrorist activities." Belgian law enforcement were widely criticized for allowing the El Bakroui brothers to evade detection when both men were on parole and at various times under surveillance. But it was only in the aftermath of the Brussels terror attacks, Van Leeuw tells me, that a clear portrait of the brothers and their radicalization emerged. Verhagen, meanwhile, feels that even now there is a reluctance to accept all that has transpired. In an email, he expresses bafflement over my conversation with Belgium's federal prosecutor. "When I reported the facts to our direction in 2016, Verhagen wrote, "the direction refused to accept this link, and the investigators of terrorism never ask for information about the stolen artifacts." In 2016, Section Art was formally dissolved, and Verhagen was assigned to another unit. But art crime cases kept coming in, and local police kept sending their files to Verhagen's boss, asking for help. So, after 7 months, Verhagen was given permission to work solely on art crime cases, albeit without a formal unit. He shares a small office with one younger colleague. In preparation for retirement, Verhagen is training her to use the database of stolen art. His colleagues sometimes tease Verhagen about how much money he stands to make as a freelance consultant, but he tells me he isn't interested in that. "All that money," he says, "I'm happy without it. He wants to spend his retirement working as a volunteer tour guide in Overies, the village where he was born. Months later, when I tell this to Archer at the FBI, he laughs. A local docent, he says, as I said, a touch of eccentricity. In the meantime, Verhagen still has crimes to solve and thieves to catch, preferring to busy himself with open cases rather than closed ones. Everyone makes his choice, he tells me. Cain, meanwhile, seems content to spend his retirement courting the moneyed private clients who Verhagen will be happy to ignore. Instead of dwelling on what his efforts might have accomplished a decade ago, Verhagen remains focused on what they can do now. These days, he says, he's worried less about high-end art thefts than collectibles like coins and stamps, which have recently become a target for suspects with known links to the Islamic State. Every day I go through Malbik Station, he tells me. Every day I'm thinking about that bomb attack. It could happen tomorrow or this evening. Before leaving Brussels, I too pass through Malbik Station on my way to a multi-faith cemetery in Schierbeek. When I arrive, a series of signs guide me to the grave of René Magritte and Georgette Berger, where I find a handsome tomb adorned with a fresh bouquet of flowers. In pursuit of the same men Verhagen once chased, I walk a short distance to a plot of land reserved for Muslim graves. The most modest of these have no headstones and are marked only with small metal plates inscribed with the names of the dead. Somewhere among them are the remains of Ibrahim El Bakrawi, buried under a false name so that his grave may not become a site of pilgrimage for other jihadists. His brother Khalid may be buried nearby, but I can't be sure. Like the masterpieces stolen from Ukli's Van Buren Museum, the whereabouts of his remains are unknown. White Flight. The day before the Capitol riot, a private jet filled with rich white Memphians zipped up to D.C. to stop the steal. Those eight passengers debunk the myth of poor little Trumpers and illuminate a much deeper cultural rift by Abigail Tracy, with illustrations by Zohar Lazar. Opening illustration shows a motley crew of white people in costume standing in front of a plane that has just landed in Washington, D.C. At 12:11 p.m. on January 5th, an eight-seat Bombardier Challenger 300 jet took off from Memphis International Airport. A little over an hour and a half and one time zone later, it touched down at Dulles, just outside of Washington, D.C. The following day, a seditious horde of Donald Trump supporters, unapologetically encouraged by him, mounted an insurrection to stop the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. "After this, we're going to walk down, and I'll be there with you," the 45th president told attendees of the Stop the Steal rally gathered at the Ellipse, a park a little over 1 mile from Capitol Hill. At 2:11 p.m., the first of the mob had breached the Capitol on the west side of the building, near the Senate chamber. At 5:34 p.m., the sergeant-at-arms informed lawmakers that the Capitol was secure. At 6:39 p.m., the Challenger was wheels up, an hour behind schedule, according to flight data. It touched down in Memphis at 7:25 p.m., back in Central Time. As the dust settled in the capital city, the aperture of the moment largely focused on the most violent, the ones with zip ties and stun guns, and the most outrageous, the shirtless QAnon shaman. And while lawmakers reckoned with what would come next, would Vice President Mike Pence invoke the 25th Amendment? Would the inauguration bring more violence? A murmur began to bubble among Memphis's lily-white country club elite. "Did you hear John Dobbs flew his buddies to the Capitol on his private jet?" A photo posted to the Instagram account of George Zanon III features the lineup: John Hull Dobbs Jr., Zanon, Carter Campbell Sr., Vince Smith and his wife Khaki Valerius Smith, brothers Dan and Bob McEwen, and Timothy Curran mug against the backdrop of the nose of a private jet alongside the caption, "Go follow at Memphis Patriots," plus a Washington, D.C. location tag. That account existed only briefly, featuring the jet photo as its profile picture and one image in its feed that seems to place the group proceeding toward the Capitol after the rally. The account has since been deleted. The plane photo also disappeared from Zanon's social media grid, otherwise a memorial to dead ducks and deer, but not before a few quietly horrified members of local society could screenshot it. As for the Bombardier Challenger itself, it is registered to Barron Partners, a limited liability company that shares the same address, down to the suite number, with Dobbs' eponymous investment firm, Dobbs Equity Partners. Cumulatively, the individuals in the photograph with the plane are worth millions of dollars, with business interests that span the Southeast, sizable stakes in auto dealerships, financial firms whose earnings rival those of Wall Street shops, a chunk of the Corky's barbecue chain, major real estate developments, hospitality services with clients including Marriott and Hilton Hotels, and registered plantations, which are used as hunt clubs. Their cohort is emblematic of a certain segment of rich white American society, where the so-called quiet part is cacophonous background noise, private schools, booster clubs, country clubs. In Memphis, there's a black tie ball and festival where men and women, including Dobbs, dress up as royalty and anoint one another queens, princesses, and kings. This society is to the manor born, and the conservatives among it have little to do with the caricature of the down-on-their-luck, economically anxious Trump voter of media lore. To wit, in the aftermath of the Stop the Steal rally and Capitol riot, a two-time Olympic gold medalist, a state lawmaker, and a successful Texas real estate agent were among those swept up by law enforcement for their involvement. When Vanity Fair asked Dobbs about the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th, he initially denied knowledge of it. "I don't know anything about a rally like that," he said in a phone conversation, suggesting that Vanity Fair might have meant to contact John Dobbs Sr., his father. Dobbs Jr. said he was about to board a plane. At the time of the call, the Bombardier Challenger 300, registered to Barron Partners, was in Colorado, and ended the conversation, but he did not hang up his phone for several minutes. During this period, Dobbs could be heard discussing the phone call from Vanity Fair. When an unidentified person suggested somebody was messing with Dobbs, he dismissed the notion. "Were you there at Coca-Cola Woods and Arkansas Hunting Club when they called me?" Dobbs said. "They called me. The Commercial Appeal, a Memphis newspaper, was going to do an article, and it was going to be publicized. It was going to be all over, you know." Gwinnett, editor's note, he likely meant Gannett, the largest U.S. newspaper publisher, which owns the Commercial Appeal, was going to pick it up. The unidentified individual responded, "No comment." Dobbs then said, "Well, I told him. I said, 'I don't know what you're talking about.'" He laughed. "You must be talking about my dad or something." Then, God, the last thing I want to do is talk to them. When the unidentified individual said, "As your part-time spiritual advisor, do not talk to them," Dobbs responded, "It wouldn't be as bad now. I don't know why. Why is it still a story for them?" None of the individuals in the photo responded to questions about their potential involvement in the Capitol riot. But the rally, which Trump promised beforehand would be wild, was an amuse-bouche. And flying a private jet to attend is not an example of passive politics. As court documents and Justice Department indictments reveal, for many alleged insurrectionists, it was Trump's rhetoric leading up to and during the Stop the Steal rally that motivated them, a dark reality that ultimately laid the foundation for his impeachment. It's hard to say what being identified might mean for the people in the picture. Do they regret having gone to the rally? Do they disavow the violent events that followed? If so, they did not take the opportunity to tell Vanity Fair. Neither did they embrace their leader. So what is the culture that cradles such individuals? And what happens in the communities where they live, work, and wield influence? Dobbs did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Dan McEwen declined to speak to the magazine when reached by phone and did not respond to further questions sent via email. Campbell, Bob McEwen, and the Smiths did not respond to multiple requests for comment from Vanity Fair. Zenon died unexpectedly on February 26th. "You guys are relative masters of the universe, yet you feel the need to be up there and participate in this coup," says one Memphis-born source who is younger but knows a number of the private jet playgroup members through various social connections. "What happened that you decided not only this is your guy, but that you're going to hop on a private jet and go up there and participate in this?" A tale of two cities. Trump handily won Tennessee in the 2020 election with 61% of the vote. But in Shelby County, which encompasses Memphis, the results were the inverse. Biden won with 64%. Traditionally, the city, 64% black and 29% white, is a blue stronghold in a sea of red. People from various backgrounds who have lived there describe a segregated world, one steeped in a rich culture, but ever tiptoeing around that tension. It's the home of Sun Studio, where B.B. King and Elvis Presley recorded, and Stax Records, the label of Otis Redding and Booker T and the MGs. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.